Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, Fresno Mayor Lee Brand joins us to talk about two big issues. Should the city become a sanctuary city for undocumented immigrants, or is it already one? And a new plan to crack down on slumlords who operate substandard rental housing. We'll also talk to Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula about efforts to bring a new medical school to the Valley, plus the changing look and meaning of murals in the Valley. It's the subject of a new book, and we'll hear all about it. We begin, though, on a national story that's been in the headlines quite a bit over the last few years, the opioid epidemic. Recently, you may have heard a startling statistic. Nationally, drug overdoses now kill more Americans than car accidents. As it turns out, the same holds true here in the San Joaquin Valley. The lion's share of those overdoses are from opioids, street drugs and heavy-duty painkillers either derived from opium or made in a lab. And as FM 89's Carrie Klein reports, health officials are trying to prevent the problem from becoming even worse.
Opioid drug addiction isn't new. But as more doctors prescribe painkillers like OxyContin and Vicodin, and as more patients turn from those to street drugs like heroin, the problem is evolving. One place to witness the changing face of addiction is Aegis Treatment Center, a clinic offering methadone, counseling, and other services to drug addicts.
I'm looking for the Drug Alliance booklet on methadone. Do we have that?
Dr. Mark Lasher is the medical director of Aegis Centers in Fresno and Merced. A wiry man in his 60s with a curly gray ponytail and a warm smile, he's been with Aegis for over a dozen years.
When I first came, we saw the hardcore heroin addicts who've been doing it for 20 and 30 years.
Since then, he says, he's seen a steady influx of more and more patients.
Now we're getting to see all these young people. Day after 18, they're walking into this clinic, and some of them, you know, like are asking to be stabilized so they could, you know, pass their biology class.
Plus, national data from the CDC show whites are overdosing at a higher rate than any other race, and recent data out of Virginia Commonwealth University confirm that in the Valley. You won't find the state's highest overdose rates here in the San Joaquin Valley. But the epidemic holds at a dull roar, with overdose rates still higher than the state average in every Valley county except one. In the six counties here, opioids claimed around 130 lives in 2013 and around 200 in 2014. Fresno County Health Officer Ken Bird says that's too many.
If we're over the state average, I don't accept that. That's how I see it.
So, in late 2015, he helped create the Central Valley Opioid Safety Coalition. It's a group of health officials, providers, and advocates putting their heads together to combat the epidemic. While they're still relatively young, they've made themselves visible throughout the Valley with efforts to train doctors, educate the public, and increase access to addiction treatment. Now, before the problem gets worse.
I can see the potential where this could really take off and go beyond what's happening nationwide.
The opioid epidemic is unique because it's largely driven by the healthcare system. In the mid-90s, pain was introduced in American medicine as the fifth vital sign, with a ranking scale from 1 to 10. Once the conversation about pain became easier, doctors began firing off more prescriptions for highly addictive opioid painkillers. In 2012, even though the United States had less than 5% of the global population, it consumed 80% of the world's opioids. In 2014, for every 1,000 residents of Fresno County, there were over 750 opioid prescriptions. Like in other parts of the country, the epidemic showed up on radar screens here only recently. Ken Bird says the idea for the coalition arose a few years ago. He was impressed with the work of Lock It Up, a local drug abuse prevention program from the California Health Collaborative.
The right moment came when I had been attending a few of their Lock It Up meetings, and seeing that really they were the only ones really addressing the problem going on right here.
As they roll out opioid interventions, Bird says the coalition hopes to see improvements, not just in overdose deaths, but also
reduction in number of emergency room visits, hospitalizations that people are doing for this, deaths from this particularly, and numbers of prescriptions and numbers of pills in those prescriptions.
Dr. Kelly Pfeiffer is a family doctor and a director at the California Healthcare Foundation. She says coalitions like this have popped up all around the state, and they're essential for getting at the root cause of the problem.
The coalitions have been incredibly effective working with local clinicians, doctors, nurse practitioners, physician assistants to figure out how to have similar community standards about when we should use opioids and for how long.
It's the first step in making sure the Valley doesn't rise any higher in national rankings. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
And our special report continues on next week's program as we learn what specific steps local health officials are trying to take to solve the problem. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. The San Joaquin Valley doesn't have enough doctors. There are a number of ideas out there about how to solve that problem. One of them is to bring a medical school to the Valley, and that's just what new legislation introduced last week by Dr. Joaquin Arambula in the State Assembly calls for. He joins us on the phone now. Assemblymember Arambula, welcome.
Thank you, Joe, for having me on.
You're calling for a new medical school at Fresno State. Why do you think this will help address the doctor shortage?
Well, first off, if the Central Valley were a state in and of itself, we would have a population that would equate to be the 27th largest state in our union. And yet we don't have a medical school within the entirety of the Central San Joaquin Valley. We struggle with having half the number of physicians, and I believe that medical literature has proven that if you can train them, they stay within the communities in which they were trained. And since we don't have a training facility within the Central Valley, I'm advocating to bring one back home.
So what exactly does this bill do? It authorizes a medical school? Does it fund it? How far does this legislation go?
AB 207 would grant California State University Fresno to be the first CSU in our state to be able to grant the degree of medical degree. That is the first step to opening up the process for discussing how we bring and then fund a school to come back to the Central Valley.
Now, this is interesting because CSU campuses traditionally don't do this. As you mentioned, Fresno State does offer a doctorate in educational leadership, also doctorates of a doctor of nursing practice and a doctor of kinesiology. This would be a big change, though. Why Fresno State? Why not, say, a UC school like UC Merced?
Great question. So first off, I want to touch on your previous point, which is that historically, CSUs have not been granted the ability to give terminal degrees, PhDs, MDs, if you will. But if they have shown to have a workforce need within a geographical area, and there's not competition within 50 miles, is historically what the state has used, then they have allowed CSUs to grant that degree. And I think that sets the precedence for us to have that discussion when we're talking about Fresno State. Now I want to answer your question directly. I would be quite interested in discussing UC Merced as an option and having a medical school there. Frankly, their discussions and focus seems to be on getting to 10,000 students by 2020, and I think we needed a medical school yesterday. And so I'm struggling to see how there's a long-term plan, something that's viable, that will open up a medical school at Merced. And because of that, I'm willing to try and push uphill and see if we can have a school come back to Fresno State.
The same day you introduced this legislation last week, President Joseph Castro of Fresno State gave a speech about his outline for the future of the university and new initiatives that he's calling for, Performing Arts Center and the like. He did not mention a planned medical school. Have you reached out to President Castro? And if so, what was that conversation like? Is he supportive of this?
We have reached out to President Castro, and I think he must be in an awfully tough position, being the head of an institution and involved in politics in our state where we have a master plan. And yet, I look at the fact that the master plan has not always benefited areas like ours, areas where we don't have a UC to be able to achieve higher degrees. Frankly, I would have loved to have come back to a medical school in the Central Valley. I did not have an option, and so I will be working hard to open up one.
Is there any idea about how much this would cost and how long it would take to accomplish this goal?
I think we can look at what the UC Riverside model as one that can give us rough estimates in terms of cost and timing. It roughly cost $100 million to be able to open up the UC Riverside campus and took the better part of about a decade to be able to get things fully up and operational. And that's the rough time frame that I'm looking at and cost as well.
Now, there's not a full-scale medical school in this part of the state, but there is a graduate medical education program at UCSF Fresno. They partner with community hospitals. There's also a new program that Valley Children's, St. Agnes, and Kaiser are working on through Stanford that has medical residents rotating through those facilities. How would this interface with those existing efforts? Is this competition? Is this something different?
So, great question, and one I'd love to be able to clear up for all the listeners. You know, you complete high school, you go to college, and after you graduate from college, if you're if you get into a medical school, you go to medical school for 4 years. And that's what I'm hoping to bring back to the Central Valley. That piece we don't have anywhere is the medical school. What you were describing, both the UCSF and the Stanford pieces, are the residency slots which occur after the medical school. And so this would be a way to create a guided pathway into those residency slots. And we would be working to try and open up more residency slots, since we're training people here, to be keeping more of the end product, the trained doctors afterwards.
Now, I've talked to some people who say, you know, solving the doctor shortage is a lot more significant, or a lot more complex, I should say, than just training more physicians. You have to be able to make sure that they can actually have a practice in the community. And we've seen the Medi-Cal expansion have a great success in enrolling new people in the Valley, around 50% of Fresno County residents eligible for the expanded version of Medi-Cal that we've had, at least so far. But I hear people say they have trouble seeing a physician, not just because there aren't enough doctors, but because the doctors who are here, in many cases, some of them won't accept Medi-Cal. The reimbursement rates are too low. What do you think about solving the Medi-Cal reimbursement issue? Is that something that is complementary to efforts like this at this time? Where do you fall on that? Because it's been controversial. The governor has said he really doesn't want to do that at this time. He's more focused on expanding access in other ways.
So, first things first, you know, I'm quite interested in figuring out and don't think that there's just a singular answer, a silver bullet, if you will, that will help us to be able to see physicians in the Central Valley, nor do I think the medical school is that silver bullet. I think it is going to have to be multifactorial, and we're going to have to look at ways and to increase rates so that providers can have and provide access to care. I think it's one thing to hand out cards to everything. I think it's another thing to actually provide and give good patient care, and think we need to be working harder to provide a more efficient government that can do just that.
Assemblymember Joaquin Arambula with us today on Valley Public Radio. He introduced a new bill last week, AB 207, that if it becomes law, would authorize a medical school at Fresno State. We'll be following that story as it develops, and that bill as it develops through the legislature. Assemblymember Arambula, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Fresno Mayor Lee Brand took office a little less than 30 days ago, and it's been an eventful first month. Last week, he unveiled his plan to tackle one of the city's biggest issues, substandard rental housing, conditions that in many cases are unsafe and unhealthy. The plan, which includes a baseline inspection of the city's existing rental apartments and homes, is one of the biggest changes in years in the way City Hall works. It's been a controversial issue for the past year and the first big test of Brand's new administration and his relationship with the city council. At the same time, Brand has been thrust into the national spotlight over the issue of whether the city should follow the lead of many in California and declare itself a sanctuary city for undocumented immigrants. Last week, Brand came out against the idea, at least in name, saying it could lead to the Trump administration cutting off federal funds to Fresno. But it turns out the issue is a lot more complicated than that. And for the last year, the city has essentially been operating as a sanctuary city in everything but in name. Yesterday, I spoke with Brand at his office in City Hall to learn more about his thinking on both issues. Mayor Brand, welcome.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
The last time the city council took up this issue, it was 2 months ago. You were on the council at that time. Now you're in the mayor's office and the issue is back for a vote. What has changed in your proposal now versus the one that Mayor Swearingen put together?
The one that the mayor put together, in my opinion, no fault to her. It was just done in a short period of time. This is very comprehensive. And the biggest challenge was to find a product that you could engage the advocates who have a point of view on one side and engage the apartment association owner group on the other side and find a solution. So as I said before with the Fresno Bee, it's not perfect for the advocate, it's not perfect for the industry, but it's a workable solution for everybody. And so this has substantially changed from the version that was heard to the council back in December.
One of the biggest issues that's in this plan now that wasn't in before is this baseline inspection. Why that change and what does that mean?
Well, the two most important components I think that a lot of people wanted to see was one, a registry. You have to register your property. Every single property has to register. And number two was a baseline inspection because it could be argued forever whether half the housing stock is substandard, 5%, 10%. When you do the baseline inspection over probably a couple of years, we're going to know exactly where that stands. So that was it's also set and designed to filter the properties, to identify the good properties, put them in a self-inspection pool, and identify the universe of substandard properties and focus all of our efforts on these substandard properties where the problems are.
Mayor Brand, this seems like a big change for the way City Hall works. Mm-hmm. Code enforcement is essentially getting a major overhaul, splitting that up into two separate right. channels. How do you begin to implement this? Walk me through okay. how this works.
Well, the methodology is different. The methodology we did was to, we realized this is one of the biggest undertakings ever done by the City of Fresno, to go out and try to inventory 90,000 apartment units. So it was set up with maximum flexibility. There's an ordinance portion that will be codified, and there's administrative regulations, which gives us the opportunity to be flexible. So as we go in this program, it's set to have an annual review every single year, and the purpose is to identify those things that are working, those things that aren't working. Are we doing what we're supposed to? Does it follow the intended purpose? So from that point of view, the methodology is different, and part of the methodology is also to bifurcate code enforcement into two separate divisions, because code enforcement has a wide assortment of duties, from moving RVs and boats to signs on commercial properties, billboards on liquor stores. So this is going to separate rental housing into one division with one singular focus, rental housing. Within the rental housing division, this new division, it's further broken into two sides. One is the proactive side. These are the inspectors that are going to go out and do all these inspections of these properties. And the second half is kind of what Steve and Clint had brought forward, the asset. These are the reactive side. So as this staff, this inspectors goes out, we want to go fast on basically a one-page State of California health and safety check. As they pass, they move on. When they identify properties that are problems or failing, then they're going to engage the reactive side, which will be the inspectors and the city attorney's office. They move on to the next properties, and the reactive side starts to deal with the property that was identified as substandard.
How much does this cost? It sounds like it's a major undertaking from that perspective and in the new budget that you're, I'm sure, working on already.
Well, the positions that were like the reactive side, the asset program, were actually approved by the council but never approved the line item positions. That'll be part of this deal. So the other inspector positions will probably come on budget-wise after July 1st. They'll be part of the budget discussions in the FY 2018 budget. This is designed to be revenue neutral. There is no cost to the owners. for the registration. But there is a cost or penalty if you don't register within a certain time or you don't register at all. There's a cost to the owners of up to $100 for inspections. So we've designed this to basically be revenue neutral. It's not going to be a burden on the general fund. And over time, we don't want to become rich off of the misery of other people, but the city's already spent a lot of time and probably passed several ordinances over the last year and a half, the vacant blighted building ordinance. They've established receiverships, in some cases doubled and tripled fines. They've accelerated the process on how they're doing it. And part of my deal will also get the city attorney to go through hundreds of codes that relate to rental housing that are embedded across several pages. They're going to reorganize those into one, which will make it easier once we identify these cases for the staff to track these cases and prosecute these cases. We're also being more aggressive. In the past, they would go to maybe a hearing officer. We can elect on certain cases to go straight to Superior Court to get a faster remediation and to send a message out that we're serious about this.
One of the criticisms that I've heard of this plan is you're starting with multifamily units and then moving on to single-family homes. Why that approach?
Well, I applied 38 years of in the business. It wasn't just I'm a council member, I'm a mayor who did my homework. I've lived and breathed this for 38 years. When I saw this database of properties, roughly 90,000, about 33, 34,000 single-family, the single-family homes are going to take a long time to identify and clarify that they are rental properties. And the way that's usually done is by a metro scan or some database where it identifies one line as the address of the property and a mailing address as a different address. Those will be sorted out and sent out to owners. But certain owners will say, well, I've got my brother-in-law living there. I've got my son living there. And they can be exempt. They can file affidavits. So that's going to take a while. Also, geographically, we're going to apartments. If I'm going to a 100-unit apartment, it's going to be a sampling, but I'm all in one day, I'm in the same place. While I'm tackling 33,000 houses, I'm driving all over the city. It's going to take a long time. So what I did do to accelerate the program and get the majority of the units under the registration and identified is I wanted to first take those problem properties that we know exist right now, tackle them, and we're using items like census tract and if there's some houses in that census tract, we will take the problem houses. So we're not excluding all the houses. We will definitely take problem houses. But this is designed to be effective, to get it done within probably a two-year period of time, because in my opinion, the way it was designed before in kind of a shotgun approach and with a list that was so long in terms of the items, it would probably take 3 or 4 years. And our goal is to get this done, to identify the substandard housing, and to correct it.
One more question on housing. We all know that there are probably more Somerset villages out there, maybe even worse. As you go around and do these inspections, it's quite possible you could find some conditions that are very severe and violations of that's not being safe. Does the city have a plan for what to do, how to respond in the event that you have more of these major issues where you need to move people out immediately?
Well, that's why this was designed, again, to be flexible, because by way of example, Sacramento has a very similar program. Sacramento has 10 city attorneys assigned to code enforcement, rental housing. We have probably a bigger population, probably a more problematic population of owners. We have two. So we can see if we start to identify hundreds of violators, we're going to have the resources on to prosecute these cases, whether they be code enforcement people, city attorneys, and potentially third-party attorneys. So, again, it was designed to work, and so my goal is that we're going to take a look at this about every 6 months and, at the end of each year and make the appropriate adjustments. And if we have an overwhelming number of cases, we're going to have to find the resources to prosecute.
We're talking with Fresno Mayor Lee Brand today on Valley Public Radio. I want to move on to the issue of sanctuary cities. You came out last week and said Fresno would not become a sanctuary city under your administration. The Fresno PD's existing department policy manual, Policy 428, that's been in place at least since last January, says it's the policy of the department that officers shall not enforce violations of immigration law or status. Are you changing changing the department policy based on your stance as stated last week, or in your interpretation, is that not equivalent of a sanctuary city?
I've spoken to Jerry Dyer, the chief of police, and the city manager. This policy we have now is no different. It's going to be the same as it was a year ago, the same as it is today, and a year from now it'll be the same. The Fresno Police Department is focused on crime and keeping our streets safe. So they will arrest people, whether they're legal or illegal, based on committing criminal acts, whether they're terrorists, they're involved in drugs or gang activity. So our official policy is essentially the same as most of the sanctuary cities in California. We simply don't label ourselves a sanctuary city, because by making that label and that proposition, then the city itself is jeopardizing federal funding, which is in the millions of dollars. We're going to identify the money coming in. And I would believe right now most of that money probably goes into southeast and southwest Fresno, where it's needed the most. It could even affect illegal immigrants in terms of the potential loss of revenues.
There's legislation in Sacramento right now that could force the city's hand, all local government's hand, on that matter in essentially making California a de facto sanctuary state. What kind of pressure would that put the city under there?
Well, I mean, I'm walking a tightrope. I have a Republican administration in Washington, D.C. I have a Democratic House and Senate and governor in Sacramento. I want to be respectful to both the agencies and governments. And what my goal is to do what's best for the city of Fresno. And so we're going into uncharted territory in terms of the edicts and administrative orders from President Trump. I don't know what's going to come out of Sacramento. Everybody has their attorneys. I know one thing is for certain, you know, if somebody's challenged, the challenge is going to be in court. So I would have the city best positioned to do the right thing, to keep us on a legal course. And again, I never imagined, you know, a year ago when I was talking to you about campaign issues, and I think this may even came up, and I think probably both myself and Henry both said we wouldn't approve sanctuary cities. But, you know, I do have a heart for the people in this community, and I know there's probably thousands of people that work in construction, service industries, agriculture. Nobody's trying to punish or make their lives different. In fact, I want to improve their lives. But, you know, we're a nation of laws. We have to navigate that very tricky course to, you know, to be legal and be compliant with both the state and the federal government. And I don't think anybody knows the answers right now.
And just to clarify on the police department policy, right now Fresno police are not complying with ICE detainers and orders, communication from ICE in that regard?
To my knowledge, they arrest people for crimes. What goes on at the county jail has nothing to do with the city of Fresno. That's a decision made by Fresno County Sheriff.
In some ways, is this a moot point in that regard, since the sheriff has ICE agents stationed in the jail? Again, not your responsibility.
That's the responsibility of Sheriff Bims.
Mayor Lee Brand, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute on Valley Edition and talk to the Armenian ambassador to the U.S. who was in the Valley last week. We'll find out what he thinks about the Trump administration and what it means for relations with Armenia. Plus, the changing face of murals across the Valley. It turns out the new generation of artists is doing something very different than what the founders of the practice did back in the 60s. We'll learn more about that all coming up here on Valley Edition.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life. And if you're hearing the sound of my voice, chances are you have heard these pledge drives come and you've heard them go year after year, and you have never pledged. That's what statistics say. If you're hearing my voice right now, you probably have never pledged yourself. And I think I may know why. I think that you have noticed that even though you do not pledge personally, somehow this radio station stays on the air. Right? I mean, come on. You hear us say, you got a call, and then you don't call. And the next week, the national programs roll out every day, and you have not given, and Scott Simon and Nina Totenberg somehow do not end up homeless on the street, right? And you have drawn the only possible logical conclusion, which is, it doesn't matter if you call. We will stay on the air. And I'm saying these words, and this is actually the greatest heresy a person can say during the pledge drive. I'm going to say them again right now. It doesn't matter if you call. I want you to remember this moment. You are never going to hear these words again on this radio station during the pledge drive. It doesn't matter if you call. I'm just going to say the absolute truth here. But frankly, I don't think that that is the whole picture. Because although reason tells you that we're going to be fine if you don't call, and reason has dictated your actions during every pledge drive till this point, you've been utterly reasonable. You've followed logic perfectly, right? I'm here to tell you, you got to walk past reason. You got to see reason standing there in the corner, you know, smoking a cigarette and looking all smug, and you're going to walk right past reason. You're going to walk past what is logical and what is reasonable to what is actually a bigger truth, and that is that you want to do what's right. And you know, okay, you know that you listen to this radio station all the time. You're hearing me right now. It's not even a program right now, okay? This isn't a pledge break, okay? That's just how much you listen to this radio station. You listen during the pledge breaks. And what is right? In the simplest way that we teach a five-year-old, you know, here's what's right and here's what's wrong. What is right is that if you use something or depend on something or share something, like you share this radio station with all the other people who listen to this radio station, it is only right to help out and keep it going. So yes, you do not have to pledge. We're going to stay on the air if you don't pledge. Somehow, we're going to come up with the money. And that's why it's such a statement when you walk by the logic of that, the undeniable logic of that, and actually contribute. That's why everybody who contributes the first time, that's why they always say, it felt so good, it felt so good, you know? Because it's such an act of faith and community and, you know, we're all in this together. You know, because the truth is, we are all in this together. You and me and all of us. And that's what you're affirming. Here's how to pledge.
Please visit kvpr.org to make your sustaining membership gift. Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. Over the weekend, Grigor Hovhannissian, the Armenian ambassador to the United States, paid a visit to Fresno. His stops included a notable visit to the new memorial commemorating the Armenian genocide. An estimated 1.5 million Armenians were killed in Turkey between 1915 and 1917. However, the U.S. government does not formally recognize the murders as genocide. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with Ambassador Hovhannissian about why he's visiting Fresno now, if he thinks the stop will pressure the U.S. government to recognize the genocide, and what he expects from the presidency of Donald Trump, who has close ties with Russia, which of course is a major player in the region.
It's notable that your visit is going to include a stop at the new Armenian Genocide Memorial at Fresno State. Why are you deciding to go there?
Absolutely. Obviously, genocide-related monuments are numerous in the United States. The one built in Fresno is unique because it's built in the compound of a state university. It's not a private land. It was built through a partnership with the Fresno University. I haven't seen that monument. Obviously, back in 2015, it broke the news. It was Armenian media, it featured quite prominently. I first need to see that, and typically any Armenian official visiting an area, a city, a community that has a genocide memorial, it's a must for us.
A big cause for the Armenian community in Fresno is to get the federal government to recognize the killings as a genocide. Current policy is not to recognize it as a genocide. Is your visit in any way trying to raise the profile of what happened in 1915 and 1970 and get the United States government to officially label it genocide?
Listen, the profile of Armenian genocide is very high. Annually, U.S. Presidents invariably make statements. There's commemorations. The state of California commemorated the highest possible level. There's textbooks that talk about that. And there's various schools of thought, obviously. Armenian-American community has, for the last 50 or 60 years, been very vocal about the necessity, the desire to see that genocide formally acknowledged by the United States. So, but this being said, many people in our community believe that, in addition to the states, which are 43 as we speak, that have formally recognized the Armenian genocide, They also want to see the federal government do that formally through the congressional vote or presidential decree.
So on this issue, and you also mentioned trade, what are you thinking about the incoming Trump administration? Do you think they'll be more favorable to labeling the Armenian genocide as such and establishing stronger trade relationships, or are you nervous about the direction with the American president?
We're in suspense, actually. We followed very closely the electoral debates, you know, programs that we had throughout the year. Fundamentals are there. You know, we do believe that we have very strong foundations for U.S.-Armenian relations. And changes in the content of the trade policy, international, particularly regional focuses, may not fundamentally change the nature of our friendly relations. The United States for Armenia is a special country. It's home to a third of our population outside Armenia, and we're not indifferent to the processes happening here. We do follow, obviously, the developments. There's going to be change in trade policy that will affect the architecture of global architecture with TPP, trade agreements. But do we feel like they're unlikely to affect our relations? We've built very solid foundations for trade in, IT sector. Armenia has benefited tremendously from the Silicon Valley, cooperation with Silicon Valley. So we do not expect any that the currently observed changes in international trade agreements, as we hear from Washington, to affect Armenia. Obviously, the overall world trade may be affected if some of these dramatic changes are implemented. But as we speak, we do not see any practical, any concrete issues that would affect our ongoing economic relations.
On one very specific issue, there could be a dramatic shift potentially. The contested region of Karabakh, I believe I'm pronouncing that correctly, remains majority Armenian but under Azerbaijani control. Interestingly, the Russians support the Armenian claim to the land. Do you think that a closer U.S.-Russian relationship might be in your benefit to seeing that region return to Armenia?
When it comes to Karabakh, we're not talking about contested land. You know, this is a republic that emerged in the wake of Soviet disintegration. It does really exist. It is populated by Armenians. It is controlled by its own people. It has a government. It has self-defense forces and is living under self-rule for the last 25 years. It has military capabilities, and it is able to defend itself. Obviously, Armenia acts as a guarantor of that republic. So there's negotiations going on for the last 20 years to which U.S. and Russia are co-chairs, mediators. And that framework that has been one of the few ones that was not affected by the deteriorated U.S.-Russia relations. So for the last couple of years, as there were major issues in other parts of the world, U.S. and Russia continued to work towards resolution of Nagorno-Karabakh problem. I think if there's an overall improvement in the climate, in the relations, the Minsk process, as we call the Karabakh resolution negotiation process, would only benefit from that. So I'm quite upbeat about that thing.
That was Grigor Hovhannisyan, the Armenian ambassador to the United States. He visited Fresno this past weekend to visit Fresno State's Armenian Genocide Memorial. He spoke with Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess. This is Valley Edition. People in the Central Valley have painted murals for decades. In the 1960s, they represented the civil rights movement and worker equality, as well as advertising for companies. But as FM89's Ezra David Romero found, many murals painted today in places like Fresno have taken on a very different tone from those painted a few decades ago.
In the 1960s and 70s, John Sierra started painting murals in the Fresno area. His paintings had a strong political bent, and many were mobile because of the lack of available walls.
It was hard. You couldn't hardly get anything up unless, you know, it was an old building that was abandoned or something. They were mostly about some of the Mexican imagery, you know, and some of the farm worker issues.
One of his murals is on a state building in downtown Fresno. It's 5 stories high and has 3 panels. Sierra painted it in the 70s, and it's called The Planting of Cultures. We're at a studio where he's showing me the original sketch.
And it shows different groups of people, and these people are all representative of different cultures.
And the mural is starting to fade, and Sierra says he hopes to restore it soon.
I pretty much use the grapevine as something, as an outline. So it's all about growing together and sharing.
He's taught a whole slew of young artists in the region when he was a professor at Fresno City College. Sierra says he's witnessed a change in the type of murals that are painted here. He says the messages the murals portray are harder to make out, because perhaps artists today aren't unified around a single cause.
We were actually a group of people, and so we had the same message. It's not that bad. It's just that I can't see myself doing something similar to what they're doing today. I still have things that I want to say that are important to me anyway.
Even still, he says the fact that murals are being painted today is a win for the region. He's talking largely about outdoor art in Fresno's mural district. Lots of the murals there are on private property, and he says they're sort of decorative. Many were funded by developers who've built loft-style homes there. But murals in the region aren't just limited to this one district. I spoke with 2 women who are documenting the area's murals for a website and a new book. They found about 200 murals in Fresno County alone.
A lot of pretty lady murals in Fresno. A lot of people's significant others, guys, girlfriends, are painted on the side of buildings.
That's Teresa Flores. She helped spearhead a project documenting murals in Fresno County called the Digital Mural Map. She and her colleague are compiling these images into a book. It'll come out this spring. For them, it's an opportunity to document the region's rich art history before it disappears. Here's her colleague, Carissa Garcia.
Muralism is an act of reclamation to say that this is where we're from, this is who we are. Let us represent ourselves and not let other people represent who we are.
Murals aren't always widely accepted by the public. About 6 years ago, Teresa Flores helped paint a large mural in Fresno's Tower District with a focus on current issues like policing.
I had painted a cop on a motorcycle holding a radar gun, and the neighbors didn't like that he was holding any kind of gun, and so I changed it to a banana. So bananas are harmless.
Flores says she hasn't found many recent murals with strong messages like this in Fresno. USC Spanish professor Consuelo Sigüenza Ortiz says she's surprised that messages of activism in murals aren't as prevalent today in Fresno. She says they are in Los Angeles.
They have a current political message, and even the murals that were done in the 80s and 90s, they're still very current in terms of issues of women's rights, minority rights, community rights.
She says the messages murals give off are dependent on both the artists and who's commissioned them. UC Irvine professor Mara Lawner says it's all right that murals today aren't always political or have a deeper meaning. She says the current political climate is a factor.
There's so many different issues that we're negotiating that it's not quite as concentrated as, say, the farm workers' rights from that period in Fresno when Cesar Chavez was so active and important.
In downtown Fresno, a new 3-story tall mural is in the process of being painted on the old Fresno B building. It's a community collaboration between Fresno artist Mado Carrera and a muralist from L.A. The duo is using a lift to paint the side of the building.
Each individual artist has a certain way of approaching a wall, and it's like dancing cumbia or something, you know, it's just like, oh, what kind of step do you do? And it's just the same beat, you know?
That was Carrera. Francisco Letelier is a muralist from Southern California. He says this mural will honor the valley's writers and poets.
It's one huge iconic figure of a young man walking along, reading a book. The pages of the book are kind of lifting off, going past him, and they're becoming birds.
When the mural is finished in a month or two, it'll be added to the digital mural map. Anyone who finds a new mural in Fresno County or who has information about a mural can add it to the map. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Thank you.
Politicians in California and Washington, D.C. are busy trying to figure out the future of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. Should it be fully repealed? What will the replacement be? Should there be a replacement at all? While the potential replacement is still a mystery, two researchers at the UC Berkeley Center for Labor Research and Education took a look at the potential impact of full repeal on the San Joaquin Valley's job market. They claim job losses from a repeal of the law and the rollback in the expansion of coverage could be worse than the job losses caused by the drought. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess spoke with researcher Laurel Lucia about how she reached that conclusion.
Jobs and the Affordable Care Act were both big issues in the election. Our research shows how interconnected they are. We estimate that the San Joaquin Valley would lose 24,000 jobs if the ACA is repealed and not replaced. That's more jobs than were lost in the entire state in 2015 due to the drought.
How do you reach that conclusion?
Well, what we did is we model the loss in federal revenue that would come to California under the Affordable Care Act. So California would lose more than $20 billion in federal health care spending, and that spending is used to support health insurance for Californians. When Californians have health insurance, they use more care, and therefore hospitals and clinics and other providers staffed up in response to the Affordable Care Act and the increased demand for health care services. If the Affordable Care Act was repealed, many of those jobs would go away. And when health care workers lose their income, they spend less money in their local communities, at restaurants, at grocery stores, at retail stores, and other local businesses. So there would be a ripple effect of job loss throughout the economy.
For a non-economist, or specifically a non-labor economist, can you just explain how the connection between the spending and job creation, and how that would work in reverse if the spending went away?
Under the Affordable Care Act, millions of Californians gained health insurance coverage, and research shows that when people have health insurance, they use more services. They especially increase their use of preventive services, mental health services, they get more care for their chronic conditions. In response to the increased use of care, hospitals and clinics and other providers have hired more staff to provide care to these patients. And if the Affordable Care Act is repealed, many of those jobs would go away.
Happening at the same time as the Affordable Care Act, though, was a big economic recovery.
Right.
Couldn't the job growth, that 17,000 or so in the healthcare field, be attributed to that?
Right. There has been significant job growth in California since the ACA was passed, and also since the insurance coverage provisions went into effect. And not all of that would be due to the Affordable Care Act. We would have expected growth in that industry regardless, but it's been much higher due to the Affordable Care Act.
But if these companies have already added these positions, is it reasonable to expect they would eliminate the positions after? I mean, there's been a big transition that's not gotten talked a lot about in how healthcare services are delivered. Is it reasonable to expect it would revert and those jobs would go away?
I think it is reasonable. The change wouldn't happen necessarily overnight. Providers might decide to eliminate those jobs via attrition or more gradually. But when demand for healthcare services decreases, when more people are uninsured, and when there's less money coming in because fewer people are insured, providers will have to reconcile that eventually.
But the Republicans would tell you that they're going to replace the Affordable Care Act, or that the state of California might step in to the gap of what the federal funding shortfall is for the Democrats in Sacramento. So is your report a little bit premature?
Well, there's no guarantee that the Republicans will come to consensus on a replacement plan and that they'll get the Democratic votes they need to pass it. They've had 6 years of debating the Affordable Care Act and haven't come to agreement on a plan yet. If they do come to agreement on a plan and it passes, that could reduce the job loss to some extent, but the extent to which it would depend on the details of the plan.
And
in terms of California, California filling in some of these gaps, California would lose over $20 billion in federal funding if the ACA is repealed, and that's a huge share of the state budget. It would be very difficult for the state to make up all of that lost federal revenue.
And conversely, all the Republican plans that I have seen floating around involve less federal spending than what Obamacare does. Even if they do pass a replacement plan, it appears likely to be less generous in the terms of federal spending than what's currently in place.
Right. Some of the Republican replacement plans do not maintain the Medicaid expansion, which is a big part of the health insurance gains in California and the job gains. Additionally, some Republican plans would change the way that the Medicaid program overall is funded, which is projected to significantly reduce the federal funding for Medicaid over the longer term. So that would reduce and result in job loss as well.
Yeah, the Medicaid one is a big one we focused a lot on here in the Valley because of our poverty rate. And I think something like more than a third of all people who are insured in the Valley are on Medicaid. So
right.
That's something we pay quite close attention to.
Right. San Joaquin Valley residents disproportionately rely on Medicaid. And that's why we focused on the San Joaquin Valley in our recent blog post and made the comparison to the drought, because the San Joaquin Valley would especially be hurt by ACA repeal because of the high reliance on the Medi-Cal expansion. So 11.2% of the San Joaquin Valley is enrolled in the Medi-Cal expansion under the ACA. That's higher than the 9.4% of Californians enrolled statewide. And in terms of Medi-Cal overall, almost 47% of San Joaquin Valley residents are enrolled in Medi-Cal compared to 34% of residents around the state.
So you are able to piece out which is Medi-Cal, or which is part of the expansion, which was part of the existing program?
Yes.
And that, so 11%, is that 11% of the newly insured people or 11% of the total populace?
That's 11% of the total population, all ages.
Is in the Medi-Cal expansion.
Right. And nearly half of the overall population is in Medi-Cal in general, the overall program.
Now, I'm glad you brought this up because I heard someone else mention that. Is that the number of people that are eligible or the number of people that are actually enrolled?
That's the number of people who are actually enrolled. So, there are additional people who may be eligible but uninsured.
That was Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess speaking with UC researcher Laurel Lucia about a report from UC Berkeley that suggests job losses from a full repeal of the Affordable Care Act could be worse than the losses suffered in the Valley as a result of the drought. Well, that's all for today's program. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us your thoughts and comments. talk@kvpr.org is our email address. You can also find us on Twitter. We are @KVPR and @Valley Edition. Find our podcast and audio archives on our website as well, kvpr.org, and the podcast about the outdoors. We call it Outdoorsy, and we produce it every month here at FM 89. Find that online as well. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.